Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome everyone. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, Pope Francis remembers St. Francis's Pardon of Assisi as its 800th anniversary is being celebrated. We take you to the Italian hill town for a look at the place where the saint obtained these very special graces. Jill Bevilacqua paints a portrait of the saint in a program on spiritual writers of the Church. And Father Peter Stravinskas takes us to the Holy Land for a reflection on the Feast of the Transfiguration. August 2016, the Franciscans celebrate the 800th anniversary of what has become known as the Pardon of Assisi. As they do each year during the first week of the month, Italian friars, the townspeople, and residents from nearby Umbrian villages gather in Assisi to pray, attend Mass, and participate in confession, giving thanks for the day so many centuries ago in which St. Francis obtained from the Pope special indulgences for sinners. And on August 4th this year, they were to be joined by an exceptional guest. Pope Francis was to come pray among them. After all, this tiny hillside town was the home of his namesake, and it was the Jubilee Year of Mercy.
Oggi si ricorda il perdono di Assisi.
Today we remember the pardon of Assisi. It is a strong call to approach the Lord in the sacrament of mercy and also to receive communion. Some people are afraid to approach the confessional, forgetting that they are not meeting a strict judge, but instead an immensely merciful Father.
Il Padre immensamente misericordioso.
And now Linda Bordoni tells us more about a very special place in the life of St. Francis, a place with a very particular Italian name.
For the Franciscans, the Porziuncola inside Assisi's Basilica of St. Mary of the Angels is one of their most cherished shrines. It was especially dear to St. Francis, who rebuilt the tiny chapel in the early 13th century. It was here in the Porziuncola that he founded the Franciscan Order. Over the centuries, the simple stone chapel has been beautifully decorated by artists depicting events from the life of the poor man of Assisi, as St. Francis is known here in Italy. The frescoes include scenes portraying the origins of the pardon or indulgence, which is celebrated each summer. According to tradition, on August the 1st, 1216, St. Francis was praying inside the chapel when he had a vision of Christ and Our Lady surrounded by a dazzling cloud of angels. Asked what he wanted for the salvation of souls, the saint responded by appealing to God to grant forgiveness to all pilgrims who visited the church. The Lord granted his request on condition that he gained approval from the Pope of that period, Honorius III. The following day, Francis went to see the Pope, who approved of his petition, and ever since then, the Feast of the Pardon of Assisi has been celebrated between Vespers on August the 1st and the evening of the following day. To obtain the pardon of Assisi indulgence, one must seek an interior cleanliness from sin, go to confession, and receive the Holy Eucharist. We are also asked to pray for the Holy Father's intentions and visit a Franciscan church.
Be surprised to know that Assisi isn't the only place where the Porziuncola can be found. There are also replicas in the United States. In 2008 in California, the Archdiocese of San Francisco built a near life-sized copy of the original chapel in a former gymnasium adjoining the Church of the National Shrine of St. Francis of Assisi. In 2010, it was placed under the care of the Capuchin Franciscan Friars of the Western American Province. There's a copy, too, at the Cardinal Cushing School in Hanover, Massachusetts, and another at the Franciscan University of Steubenville, and yet another at the Mount St. Sepulchre Franciscan Monastery in Washington, D.C. Just who was St. Francis of Assisi? Jill Bevilacqua tells us in this program on Spiritual Writers.
Francis of Assisi, the one saint whom all succeeding generations have succeeded in canonizing, is probably the best-known saint in the whole calendar.
The 19th-century French Protestant writer Ernest Renan declared that, after Jesus, he was the only perfect Christian. Pope Pius XI, in an encyclical celebrating the 7th centenary of the death of Francis, said the same.
Whether or not Francis was the one and only perfect Christian, comments biographer Abbe Engelbert, he was certainly the only Christian to take Christ quite literally at his word. No one else has ever dared to do so.
Perhaps Thomas Merton comes closest to the truth when he says, "Merely to know St. Francis is to understand the gospel, and to follow him in his true, integral spirit is to live the gospel in all its fullness."
Francis was born in Assisi around the year 1181. His father was a rich cloth merchant, and as a young man, Francis enjoyed wearing fine clothes and taking part in feasting and revelry with the other fashionable young men of the town.
But Assisi was not the peaceful place it is today. War, wrote Fortini, an historian and former mayor of Assisi, was the preferred occupation, the favourite passion of this town.
Francis grew up in the atmosphere of civil war, and like most young men of his acquaintance, he dreamed of going to war and winning glory and knighthood.
But a series of incidents in his life brought him gradually to another way of thinking. When he was about 20, Francis took part in a battle on the Tiber between neighbouring Perugia and his hometown. Perugia won, and Francis spent a year languishing in a Perugian prison.
This experience was followed by a serious illness, which left him listless and with a strange distaste for former joys. He returned to his customary occupations, including that of serving in his father's shop. But he still dreamed of war, and when the opportunity presented itself of fighting for the Pope, he prepared himself excitedly.
Before he left home, Francis had a strange dream. he saw his house changed into a place full of weapons for war. A voice told him that these were all his, and that there would also be a bride for him to marry.
Francis took this to be an omen of his success in battle, and the next day he saddled his horse and set off to join the pontifical army in Apulia.
But he never got there. That night he stopped to rest at Spoleto, and there he had another dream. The same voice asked him where he was going. To the war, he replied eagerly.
And who will do better for you, the servant or the master? The master, answered Francis. Then why are you seeking the servant instead of the master? Lord, what do you wish me to do? Said Francis. Return to the place of your birth. There you will be told what you are to do.
From that moment, life changed for Francis. But it was not an easy conversion. He was not suddenly illuminated or told to found an order. It was a slow process. He prayed, he meditated. He retired to a cave outside the town and for a long time found no peace. Then he came out, radiantly happy. He had fallen in love. All the visions were now clear to him. His weapons were to be spiritual ones. His bride, the Lady Poverty.
But there were further steps to be taken along the road. Francis had always been generous, and he now dedicated himself to the poor, giving them food, money, and clothing.
Still, he was not yet one of them himself, and there was another test in store for him. In prayer, God had told him, "If you would find me, despise the things of this life, renounce yourself, and prefer bitterness to sweetness, for only thus can you come to full understanding."
Francis himself tells in his testament what the bitterness was that he had to prefer.
While I was in sin, it seemed very bitter to me to see lepers. And the Lord himself led me among them, and I had mercy upon them. And when I left them, that which seemed bitter to me was changed into sweetness of soul and body. And afterward I lingered a little and left the world.
Francis was riding his horse one day when he came face to face with a leper. His first instinct was to turn and flee, but then he remembered what he had been told. He got down off his horse and took the man in his arms, thrusting money into his hand. Next day, he went to the leper house and made friends with all the inmates, asking their pardon for having held them all in disgust.
Shortly afterwards, Francis was praying one day in the little ruined chapel of San Damiano. Suddenly, the figure of Christ on the crucifix called out to him, "Francis, go and repair my house, which, as you see, is falling into ruin."
Francis tended to take things literally, and on this occasion he believed he was to restore the church of St. Damian. Only later did he realize that God meant the whole church.
He rushed off home and took some of the richest bales of his father's cloth and rode off to Foligno, where he sold the lot, and his horse into the bargain, so that he had to walk 3 leagues home. He took the money to the priest at San Damiano, but the priest refused it, so Francis tossed the purse onto a window ledge in the church.
When his father heard, he was furious and locked his son up, but Francis' mother soon freed him, and he hid for a time outside the town. Then his father brought a law case against him, and Francis decided to put himself under the protection of the bishop.
Standing between his father and the bishop, in the presence of a huge crowd, Francis took off his fine clothes and laid them at his father's feet, declaring that now he wished to serve God, he would call only God his father. He had now cut all ties and was a free man.
One last incident served to show Francis the way his future lay. After San Damiano, he had restored other churches, and the last of these was the little chapel in the woods that was to be the hub of the Franciscan world, the Porziuncola, the little portion of land. It was while he was hearing Mass there one day that he heard the passage in the Gospel where Christ established the rule of conduct for his disciples.
"Go, preach, saying the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers. Freely you have received, freely give. Provide neither gold nor silver nor brass in your purses, nor scrip for your journey, neither 2 coats, neither shoes, nor yet staves. for the workman is worthy of his meat. And into whatsoever city or town you shall enter, inquire who in it is worthy, and there abide till you go thence. And when you come into a house, salute it. And if the house be worthy, let your peace come upon it.
When the priest explained that this meant that the disciples of Christ had received the order to preach everywhere penitence, without carrying anything with them, and to depend on God alone to provide for their needs, Francis cried out, "This is what I wish. This is what I am seeking. This I long with all my inmost heart to do."
It was the final revelation. Now he had no more doubts. And from that moment on, until his death 18 years later, Francis did just that. He threw away his staff, his smart cloak, his shoes and his leather belt, leaving himself only a tunic which he tied with a cord and making himself a rough cloak.
It was not long before Francis was joined in his new life by other young men, and when the company had reached a round dozen, they went to Rome in the year 1210 to ask the Pope's blessing on their rule.
2 years later, a young girl named Claire left her family home to follow Francis, and so the poor Claires were established.
"Listen, little poor ones called by the Lord, who have come together from many parts and provinces. Live always in truth, that you may die in obedience. Do not look at the life outside, for that of the spirit is better. I beg you through great love to use with discretion the arms which the Lord gives you. Those who are weighed down by sickness, and the others who are wearied because of them, all of you, bear it in peace. For you will sell this fatigue at a very high price, and each one of you will be crowned queen in heaven with the Virgin Mary."
In his testament, written just a few weeks before his death, Francis tells how he and his first friars lived.
"And those who came to receive life gave to the poor everything which they were capable of possessing, and they were content with one tunic, patched inside and out, with a cord and short trousers. And we had no desire for anything more. We who were clerics used to say the office as other clerics did. The lay brothers said the Our Father, and we quite willingly stayed in churches. And we were simple and subject to all. And I used to work with my hands, and I still desire to work, and I firmly wish that all my brothers give themselves to honest work. Let those who do not know how to work learn, not from desire of receiving wages for their work, but as an example and in order to avoid idleness. And when we are not paid for our work, let us have recourse to the table of the Lord, seeking alms from door to door."
Francis forbade his friars to accept churches or houses not in conformity with holy poverty, and to accept only such hospitality as fits their profession as strangers and pilgrims on earth. Nor were they to accept the protection of pontifical favours.
Later, Francis' original intention was adapted by other people, and the friars began to live in houses, and the simple lifestyle of their founder was abandoned. Francis himself resigned the office of Minister General and lived his last years with a few devoted followers.
On Mount Laverna in 1224, he received the stigmata, the marks of Christ's passion, and 2 years later died in Assisi at the Porziuncola, the Franciscans' first home.
Francis was canonized only 2 years later.
And thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that program with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Gloria, 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 in excelsis Deo, et gloriamus, ans, ans omnibus.
It's in all four Gospels and is a miracle that confirmed the apostles in their faith that Jesus was not just human, but divine. Saints Matthew, Mark, and Luke recount the story in vivid detail. Jesus led his disciples, Peter, James, and John, to a high mountain where he was transfigured before their very eyes. His face shone as brightly as the sun, and his garments became as white as snow, bathed in pure light. Christ was revealed to his chosen apostles in a dazzling brightness produced by the shining forth of his inner divinity. The great Hebrew prophets Moses and Elijah appeared by the Lord's side, recognizing him and adoring him. And God the Father proclaimed him his only begotten Son. It was a glorious revelation of the Lord, which was to help fortify the disciples to face the terrible trials that were to befall them not long after, with Christ's arrest and crucifixion. By long tradition, the mountain on which Christ was transfigured is generally held to be Mount Tabor in Galilee. The site was marked in early centuries by a series of small stone and marble chapels, which almost disappeared under rubble and trash after long periods of conquest and Christian persecution. Shrines, including the Greek Orthodox Church of St. Elijah and the Franciscan Basilica of the Transfiguration, stand on the site today. Scholar and author Father Peter Stravinskas takes us up Mount Tabor for that breathtaking moment of Christ's transfiguration.
The church celebrates the Feast of the Transfiguration on August the 6th, but that gospel is also used in the Roman Rite on the second Sunday of Advent. What is the mystery of the Transfiguration all about? As I've tried to explain it to high school students, for example, I say, it's like going into a movie theater while the previous show is going on, and you see the end before you see the beginning. This was our Lord's way of strengthening that inner group of Peter, James, and John for the scandal of the cross. If they had simply been thrown into it, God knows what they didn't fare too well even with this experience. But as a matter of fact, they see Christ in glory. And he's flanked by Moses and Elijah, symbolizing the law and the prophets. And by being flanked by them, obviously that means he's the center of it all. Law and the prophets find their completion, their fulfillment in him, in his person. Peter's reaction is very, very amusing in many ways. He likes the whole thing and says, let's stay a while. Let's build three tents here, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. Now, if you've had the experience of going up Mount Tabor, I've never walked it, but I've done it by cab, and even by cab, it's an arduous trip. And you can imagine if these three disciples with our Lord made the trek up that mountain, I would be eager to stick around for a while, too, just humanly speaking. But Peter, we have to presume, had a more spiritual motive as well. He was beholding Christ in glory, and this was a very powerful experience. And this is, of course, what we're all aiming for, the beatific vision in the life of heaven. But Jesus rejects his suggestion. He says, no, 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 we have to go. And these fleeting moments of intense communion with God, which we as Catholics ought to be experiencing every time we receive Holy Communion, because as a matter of fact, we do receive the glorified, transfigured Christ, are transitory moments. These are not perpetual states of mysticism. And the lesson is, what we've received in that sacramental encounter, in that transfiguration of ourselves, gives us the necessary equipment to go back down into the valley of the world, live the gospel there, evangelize the world, evangelize the culture. And that is something that the disciples had to learn, and learn the hard way. It's not a question of action versus contemplation in the Christian life. These are two absolutely essential complementary components of the Christian life. But as a matter of fact, for most of us who are not cloistered nuns, it does mean that it is day-to-day hard work, and doing it often in darkness, in obscurity, not getting the benefit of the joy of the mystical experience. But what we do get and what we should be getting, as I say, from the sacred liturgy, is this experience of the transcendent.
Why did Jesus tell the disciples on the Mount Tabor not to go back down and tell everybody what they had seen?
I think this goes back to a point that we've looked at earlier. He was not one who wanted to bring people to himself by means of the quick fix.
He did say, until the Christ has risen.
That's right.
Until Christ has risen.
Yeah. And then everything in proper order. And I think that's also a key to the work of evangelization for us. Don't attract people by the unusual, the bizarre. Christ works in and through the normal warp and woof of human affairs. And it's there that we find him. We do find him in the extraordinary, which ought to be the sacred liturgy. This is one of the more unfortunate aspects of liturgical experiences of so many Catholics in the past 40 years, is that the liturgy has been made banal and mundane. When we go into a church, the physical building itself ought to inspire us with the sense of the transcendent. And then what we experience there ought to be so otherworldly that we do leave all these cares behind. In the Byzantine liturgy, the liturgical assembly is admonished to leave behind all earthly cares. We're entering into, we're piercing the veil, we're going behind the veil into the experience of eternity. And when that doesn't happen in our liturgical experiences, then we have nothing to offer. We've gained nothing ourselves, and we have nothing to offer when we leave. And so the use of the most beautiful vestments, the most magnificent art, inspiring music that is unique to a liturgical experience, all of these are not evasions of reality. It's penetrating reality in a much deeper way, with the awareness that we're not going to be able to stay there, but that what we've gotten there is such that we'll be able to live the Christian life the rest of the week.
Father Peter Stravinskas is founder of the Priestly Society of Cardinal John Henry Newman and is editor of The Catholic Response. Time for today. Thanks for joining me. I'm Tracy McClure. You've been listening to Vatican Radio's English feature program, direct from Rome. And don't forget that you can find this and many other stories on our website. Just check it out at rv.va. You can like our Facebook page, and we're also on Twitter. Again, thanks for listening. Laudator Jesus Christus.